sandwiches. It wasn't full yet, but there was a happy buzz of conversation and an atmosphere of anticipation for the night ahead. Cormac approached the bar, angling for the young woman serving pints. Lanigan was at the other end of the bar, no longer the handsome, open-faced young man of the photographs. He was in his 60s now, balding, and with the grey skin of a long-term smoker. The barmaid tilted an inquiring face in Cormac's direction, and he ordered a pint he had no intention of drinking. He took it to a corner table and sat at an angle that would allow him to keep an eye on Lanigan without being obvious about it. He was about to settle into a half hour of nursing his pint when he realized that he recognized someone sitting at the far end of the bar, Liam Hearn, reading a newspaper, a coffee cup on the table in front of him. Strandhill was his hometown, of course, but it hadn't occurred to Cormac that he would bump into him here. When Danny had told him that Liam had turned to the drink, Cormac's first thought had been of an old mentor of his who'd gone exactly that way, bitter and broken and searching for solace in a bottle. His second thought had been surprise that it would happen to Liam. He'd never seemed the type. Liam was smart enough and hard enough to go as far as he wanted in the guards. The fact that he'd never wanted to be more than a Garda working a small seaside town didn't take from the fact that he was one of the best Cormac had ever met. Liam looked up from his newspaper, calmly caught Cormac's eye, and returned his attention to the paper. He took a sip from the coffee cup. Well, it didn't look like he was drinking tonight, unless that coffee was Irish. Cormac glanced at Lanigan, still there, serving shots to a group of girls who were probably legal. He stood and went to Liam's table. "Not talking to me, Liam," said Cormac. He'd meant it as a sort of light-hearted opening, and it was only as he finished the sentence that it occurred to him Liam might have heard the rumours too. Liam, who knew everything that went on from Donegal to Cork. But Liam folded his newspaper.
"I thought you might be on the job," he said. "You have that look about you."
He nodded to the seat opposite him. Cormac grimaced as he took the seat. He was that obvious. Better then that he was chatting to Liam than sitting alone, if Lanigan happened to observe him.
"I hear you finally retired. What are you doing with yourself?"
Liam seemed mildly amused.
"A bit of this, a bit of that."
"How's Coich?" Cormac asked.
"She's grand. Busy. Sinead has started in UCD, so that's the last bird out of the nest. But they still managed to keep Coich running."
"Fair dues to her." Liam nodded and glanced towards Cormac's left hand.
"No sign of you settling down. Not getting any younger, you know."
"I'm seeing someone,"
Cormac said. He felt awkward. He liked and respected Liam, and he wanted him to know that. "You'll have to meet her. Will you and Coit come out for a night in Galway next time you're down?" Liam was watching him with his cool, careful blue eyes.
"We'll do that, Cormac. If you give me your number, I'll call you next time we're coming down."
Liam's coffee cup was empty.
"You're not drinking?"
Cormac asked.
"Driving. Sinead's home for the weekend. She's in the competition. I'll wait for her, drive her home. But I'm about to eat if you'll join me, or are you tied up?"
Liam's eye turned to the bar. They ordered food, waited, ate together. Lanigan showed no signs of leaving the bar. He brought their sandwiches, served them with professional indifference. Cormac and Liam ate and talked, and Cormac found a collegial ease with Liam that he hadn't felt since he left Dublin. He finished his pint without meaning to, and found himself talking about the Blake case. He trusted Liam Hearn. He'd always been one of the good guys.
"There's someone pushing this thing, Liam. Maybe Murphy. Maybe someone pulling his strings. The mother died 20 years ago with the needle in her arm. Did Maud put it there? I don't know. Maybe she just had enough of the abuse. But if she'd taken it for 15 years, you'd think she could take it for a few more months. Then the kids would have been fostered and Maud wouldn't have had to run."
Cormac stopped for a second, but Liam was listening carefully.
"The thing is, even if Maud did kill her mother, I can't see how we can ever prove it. The nearest thing we have to evidence is a statement from a drug addict who wants to get out of prison, and even she doesn't claim to have seen it happen. So why was Maud Blake charged?"
"And you're asking me because you think I'll have some sort of blinding insight into your case?"
The look Liam gave him left him nowhere to go.
I'm asking you because I can't get a grasp of the politics, and I can't run my case if politics get in my way.
You think she's innocent?
I don't know.
He shook his head, hesitated.
I don't know.
Liam studied him for a long moment.
Go back to the last interview. That woman, Keen. She gave you a name?
Simon Schmidt, but I think that was bullshit. We ran a search and got nothing.
Not Schmidt, Liam said. Schiller. She's talking about Simon Schiller.
Cormac said nothing, raised an eyebrow.
This happened when? You said 20 years ago, so 1993.
Cormac nodded.
Simon Schiller was a teacher in Uncarrach National School. It's only about 20 miles from Kilmore. He wasn't a priest, but he was a minister of the Eucharist and was involved in some sort of children's group. They arranged holiday camps for children in care. Schiller was a paedophile. We got him in 2005. He died in prison 2 years ago.
Cormac stared at him.
Schiller went after little boys. The youngest victim that we know of was 6 years old. Schiller was very into his religion. That Keen one sounds like his sort of person. She may have given you a name because she thought you were close and didn't want to be charged with obstruction. She could always claim she got the names mixed up in her old age.
Cormac closed his eyes involuntarily. He saw little Jack again. Saw Maud with her hand pressed gently to his back as the squad car bounced over ruts and potholes. Saw the little boy's bruises.
Jesus,
he said in the end. He felt an ache through his whole body.
She did it. She did it to get Jack out. To get him away. Because her mother couldn't, or wouldn't.
Liam was watching him, his eyes unreadable. He didn't speak for a long time, and when he did, he looked away.
I've met a lot of victims, Cormac. A lot of families. Most of them had no idea, no clue what was happening to their children. They're broken by it, even decades later. But there are a few, a very few, who knew and turned a blind eye. If you talk to them now, they will plead ignorance, claim that no one suspected anything in those days. If the bastard was a priest, they'll claim shock at the very idea. But you can always see it in their eyes, the ones who knew and did nothing because it was easier. Or maybe because they were afraid or just couldn't accept it. If this girl was willing to do what it took to save her brother when her mother gave him up, I say give her a fucking medal.
They're not giving her a medal, Liam. They're charging her with murder. They want her locked up.
And Danny had been right all along. Cormac had had blinkers on about this case. He'd wanted Maud to be innocent to the point where he hadn't accepted evidence that had been handed to him on a plate. She'd murdered her mother. And for 20 years, he'd failed to see it. Liam said nothing. Cormac tried to read his expression, then realized he was expecting Liam to deliver a solution, neatly wrapped up in a bow, if possible. He felt a sinking depression.
This Schiller thing, Cormac said in the end. It's motive.
Is it, though?
Liam said. He looked around the pub.
I'm not a cop anymore. Or just a pair of old colleagues catching up over a beer. And maybe I'm wrong. You were given a name. Maybe that's the name you put in your report.
Christ, Liam, you're not a cop anymore, but I am.
And if he'd been so wrong about Maud, could he have been wrong about everything? Could she have had something to do with Jack's death?
No, just no way. He didn't believe it, and there was still the question of why he'd been put on the case in the first place.
Do you think she could know something? He asked Liam.
Could she have known something from those years that someone wants to keep a secret? Someone with the power to force a Garda investigation and a prosecution.
But Liam was shaking his head.
It's possible, but I doubt it, Cormac. Schiller wasn't my case, but an old partner of mine was on it, and I know the details. He wasn't alone, but we know his, affiliates. I don't think we missed one. Then again,
he shrugged,
I can't say it's not possible.
Liam's eyes went to the door, then to his watch.
It was dark outside. His daughter would be here soon. Cormac watched him for a long moment before speaking.
Danny said you had a drink problem.
What?
Liam looked bemused by the change of topic. He smiled as if waiting for a punchline. But Cormac was suddenly absolutely sure that what Danny had told him was bullshit.
Danny McIntyre told me a detailed story about you. He said that the last few years had taken their toll, that you'd retired and hit the bottle, and that Coit didn't want you spending your time with cops.
Liam's eyes had lost their amused glint.
Did he now?
He said.
What do you know, Liam? Cormac said. What do you know that Danny wouldn't want me to know?
I don't know anything about your case, Cormac. Nothing more than I've told you.
But there is something, something you haven't told me. Something he knows you know.
For the first time in the conversation, Liam looked less than comfortable. He put a hand to his mouth, rubbed his jaw.
There's things Danny might not want you to know that have nothing to do with what you're working on. Secrets he'd keep for personal reasons. Professional, too.
Secrets you've been keeping for him?
Cormac asked, and the question was more pointed than he'd intended. Liam shrugged.
I have to ask you to tell me, Liam, Cormac said. There's something not right here. It's been off from the beginning. And I don't know if Danny's part of it, but I need to know if I can trust him.
You're asking me to trust you too, Cormac,
Liam said. He rubbed his jaw again, apparently reached a decision.
You might not know that Danny has a sister. Much younger than him, she'd be about 18 now.
Yes.
Cormac thought Liam was about to tell him about Lorna's disappearance, and he was distracted, trying to work out how there could possibly be a link between that and secrets Danny might be keeping. It took him a moment to realize that Liam was telling him a very different story.
Lorna's a nice girl. Quiet. She went out one night with friends to Westies, you know it? A nightclub in one of the villages. It has buses that collect kids from around the countryside. She got the bus there with friends, but came home alone the next morning, off her head on something or other. She'd had her drink spiked. Someone brought her into a back room to sober her up. After the club closed, two men came into that room and raped her.
Jesus Christ.
One of them drove her home afterwards and dropped her at the gate like nothing had happened. Anyway, Lorna pressed charges and two men were arrested. One of them was Angus Barton, a local farmer. Owns 100 hectares out near Loch Mask. The other was Jim Kavanagh, owner of the club.
Big Jim, Cormac said. The man Danny arrested for drug dealing.
Liam nodded.
Jim Kavanagh and his mate were charged all right, but Lorna dropped the charges less than a week later. The rumor was that they'd taken photographs, posted one on the internet. The message Lorna took from that was unless she wanted a lot more published for the world to see, she would drop the charges. So that's what she did. Can't blame the girl. She would have known too that the chances of conviction were small.
And Danny goes on to arrest her rapist for drug dealing. Did no one think there might be a conflict of interest?
Liam gave a shrug. Clearly no one had given a shit either way. Cormac rubbed his eyes.
Jesus, Liam. Do you think he did it?
The rape or the drug dealing?
Liam asked.
The drugs. That was Danny setting him up, wasn't it? To get revenge.
And could he even blame him? He thought about Emma. If he'd been there the day she was attacked, he would have ripped the fucker's head off his shoulders. But this felt different. This was half the police force in the west of Ireland knowing what Danny was about and turning a blind eye. And everyone who did that had a smudge on their record. What would they do next time a colleague asked for a small favour, a colleague who knew, after all, that they'd known about Danny McIntyre? And what would they do when that small favour turned into a big favour? The line was there for a reason. It mattered. It had to be respected, no matter how hard that was. Liam was watching him.
She's missing, Cormac said.
What?
Danny's sister. She's been missing for 2 weeks.
That's not good.
No.
They sat in silence while Cormac thought it all through. How many officers would have known? Did Murphy know? Why the promotion?
They wanted him out of the village, didn't they? Wanted him in Galway where they could keep an eye on him.
Liam shrugged. But why let him away with it? Was it sympathy? A brothers-in-arms wish to take a rapist down, no matter the method? He could believe that of some, but not Brian Murphy.
Where did Danny get the drugs, Liam?
I don't know.
I'd say you can guess.
Liam met his eye but said nothing. The drugs had to have come from a bust. Danny must have taken them from evidence, but could he have managed that alone? There were evidence logs that would have to be changed. Too many people would have had to be actively complicit. Did Healy know? Was that where the strain came from, between Danny and the rest of the drugs team? He tried again with Liam, but Liam either didn't know the answers or wasn't willing to provide them. Cormac remembered why he was there in the first place and looked around for Lanigan. There was no sign of him. There were two girls behind the bar, serving the growing crowd, but no sign of Lanigan.
He's gone out the back,
said Liam.
What?
Your man you're here to keep an eye on. He's gone out the back for a fag. He'll be back in a minute.
Liam stood.
My daughter's here,
he said. He opened his wallet and took out 20 euro, left it on the table.
Give that to the young one behind the bar for me, will you?
A quick handshake, and he was gone. Cormac paid for the meal, ordered coffee, and waited for Lanigan to return. He was back before the coffee had cooled enough to drink. Cormac abandoned it on the bar, left through the front door, and walked around to the car park. Cormac wasn't in the mood to wait. He opened the passenger door to Fisher's car.
We'll have to be quick, he said.
They walked to the back door of the pub. Fisher had a torch at the ready. Two cigarette butts, smoked down to the filter, lay on the ground by the door.
He didn't even blink, Fisher said. Didn't even notice that the pot was gone, that the place was cleaned up.
It was dark, Cormac said, or dark enough. And Lanigan's a creature of habit. He's not thinking when he comes out here, just going through the motions.
He took two quick photographs as Fisher pulled on a pair of gloves, then bagged the butts. They walked back to Fisher's car.
Send it to Dublin, Cormac said. This one shouldn't need to go to the UK. I'll have the American profile sent over for comparison. Then we'll see. You understand that we won't be able to get him for the Hughes case, not unless something unexpected turns up. But her family will know, right? If we get him for the American murder, you'll go to Maury Hughes' family and let them know?
Yes, Cormac said.
It would be a kind of closure for them. And once Lanigan was jailed, there was always a possibility that he would give up the location of Maura's body. Fisher nodded.
I'd like to be with you for that conversation, if it's all right.
Cormac nodded.
Thanks,
said Fisher.
The DNA, it'll take a few months, do you think?
Cormac shrugged. Fisher knew the answer to that as well as he did. No one skipped the queue at the state lab, not unless you had a politically significant case or a lot more pull than Cormac had. This case was too old, the connections they'd drawn too tenuous. They would have to wait. In the meantime, there was other work to be done. The drive back to Galway was a somber one. He hadn't needed to be there for the Lanigan DNA collection. It was something he could easily have left to Fisher in another uniform. He'd gone because he wanted the distraction, wanted time away from Galway to think. But now that it was done, and there was nothing between him and Monday morning except a bad night's sleep, he felt tired and defeated. What the fuck was he going to do about Danny? The line that Danny had crossed, it was sacrosanct for Cormac. Never to be crossed, mostly because once crossed, how would you stop yourself from crossing it again, and then maybe the threshold for crossing it would drop, until you found yourself justifying every corrupt step you took in the name of some nebulous greater good. But Danny'd been protecting his sister, or avenging her. And if Cormac went after Danny, what then? Half the Gardaí in the country, probably more, would condemn him for it. He'd have a target on his back for the rest of his career, which would probably be considerably shortened. And Maud Blake, he'd found her motive and it was compelling. Motive was not relevant to a criminal offence.
Not under the law. Intent was what mattered. And yet, juries needed a motive if they were to convict. And judges weren't immune from this either. He should give Hackett the motive. It might be what was needed to push the case over the line, and he believed it now. Maud had killed her mother. He felt sick at the thought. What could he do? He was a policeman to his bones, but he couldn't give Maud up for this. Despite his racing thoughts, Cormac felt his eyelids grow heavy, and he opened his window to let in some chilly air, turned on the radio. News bulletins in Irish. Switched again, heard the opening riff of AC/DC's Whole Lotta Rosie. He had a sudden flashback to Temple Moor, to their graduation dance. He'd joined the guards straight out of school and had been 20 when he graduated from Temple Moor. They'd all ended up in Thurles afterward, at a nightclub that still played slow dances. God, they'd been so young. Glad to get out of their ill-fitting uniforms, put on jeans and a t-shirt, sink a few, far too many, pints. It hadn't been about the girls that night. So many nights were about finding a girl, but not that one. He remembered the opening riffs of Whole Lotta Rosie had played, and almost every one of them had hit the dance floor and gone mad in a sudden testosterone-laden mosh pit. There had been female trainees. They'd either joined in or stayed at the bar watching the scene, amused by it maybe. Danny hadn't joined in, Cormac remembered now. He'd stayed at the bar too. When Cormac had asked him about it, he'd said he didn't like the song. Curled a lip. The song and the radio came to an end and the news headlines started again. There was more talk about austerity politics, more talk of protests about home and water taxes. Same old, same old. He was reaching for the dial when he heard it. The body of a young woman had been found inside a car submerged in a flooded quarry near Loch Mask in County Mayo. She had not yet been identified. A man, the owner of the land on which the quarry was located, had been taken into custody on suspicion of murder and was being questioned at Castlebar Garda Station. Loch Mask. Christ. Lorna McIntyre. It had to be. Chapter 31. Aisling drove straight home. She turned the heat up to maximum, but it was 20 minutes before she stopped shivering. Jack's phone sat on the passenger seat. She glanced at it every now and again, as if it was a live thing that might hurt her. Her hands left brown and red smears on the steering wheel. She wiped them on her jeans. She should have waited for the police at the main road, should have found out what they were searching for, made sure that they knew about the connection to Jack. But she'd been so afraid. Her earlier fear should have seemed stupid as she drove into Galway, down well-lit streets, busy with traffic. But the taste of it was still with her, sour and curdled on her tongue, as she pulled in outside the house. She went to their bedroom first. Jack's charger was still plugged in on his side of the bed. She connected it to the phone, waited, tried switching it on. Nothing. Aisling checked her watch and could have screamed in frustration. She was due at the hospital in less than 2 hours. With an enormous effort of will, she left Jack's phone plugged in and headed for the shower. She dropped her dirty clothes in a heap onto the bathroom floor and was climbing into the shower before the water had a chance to warm up. It took far longer than she had patience for to scrub the dirt from her hands and nails to wash her hair. But when she got out of the shower and returned to the phone, it still wouldn't switch on. Damn it. Maybe it had gotten wet, or the fall that had cracked the screen had broken something more fundamental. Aisling pulled a pair of jeans from her drawer, a t-shirt, an old jumper. She would get a set of scrubs at work. She told them she was coming in for this shift. She couldn't change her mind again, or be late, or they'd think she'd turned into a total flake. But first she had to get to the Garda station. She paused long enough to send a message to Maud, telling her that she'd found the phone and was bringing it to the police. Aisling felt she owed her that much. She got to the station just after 7, went straight to reception and asked for Cormac Riley. Not available. Kerry Walsh, too, was off duty. In desperation, she asked for Rogers and was met with a polite suggestion that she return in the morning.
That was when she raised her voice, said she wanted to make a formal complaint, said she had evidence her boyfriend had been murdered and the police weren't doing anything about it, said that if she didn't get to speak to someone in the next 10 minutes, she was going straight to the newspapers. She felt sure that Maud would have been proud of her performance. Unfortunately, shouting got her nowhere. She was told, reasonably politely, by a now harried-looking young Gartha, that he couldn't produce officers who weren't in the building, and as the Gardaí had a lot on at that moment, there was no one who could see her. If she'd like to take a seat and wait, he would see what he could do. Or alternatively, she could come back in the morning. She left, feeling like she was letting both Jack and Maud down, and was halfway to her car when she heard her name called.
Miss Conroy!
She turned, and the man who'd arrested Maud, looking much less police-like now, was standing in front of her dressed in jeans and a ratty jacket, open over a Grateful Dead t-shirt.
You wanted to speak to someone about Jack's death?
He said. Yes. She checked her watch. I was hoping to speak with Detective Sergeant Riley, but he's not there.
Is there something I can help you with?
His eyes dropped to Jack's phone, which she still held in one hand. He glanced over his shoulder towards the station. I don't think so, said Aisling. She could come back. One more day couldn't make much difference.
You told the duty officer that you had evidence Jack was murdered. If you do, I'd like to hear about it.
Aisling hesitated. This was the man who had arrested Maud, after all. It didn't feel right to hand Jack's phone over to him. But he had the kind of face you could trust, the kind that looked like it could break into laughter at any moment. He looked back over his shoulder again. He must be in the middle of something, whatever it was that was taking so much Gartha attention that evening. And she was going to be late for work. So Aisling talked, quickly. She said that she'd been wrong to ever even consider that Jack killed himself, that he would never, ever have done so. She talked about the CCTV footage. Standing there in the car park, she talked about the post-mortem results.
And that?
He said in the end, nodding towards the phone. It's Jack's phone, she said. I tracked it. Jack went to Loch Mask on the day he died, to hike. I found his phone there in the mud at the bottom of the trail. Something happened to him there. What if someone hurt him, then drove him to Galway and dropped him in the river to make it look like a suicide? She got it all out in one fast sentence, afraid that she might sound hysterical, but desperate to be taken seriously. Something flashed in McIntyre's eyes, but it was gone too fast for her to read.
Loch Mask,
he said. Yes, Jack liked to hike there. I have his email password. I tracked his phone. That's where he went that last day. I drove there myself this morning to see if I could find his phone, and I did. It was just sitting there at the bottom of the trail, half covered in mud. She didn't say anything about her desperate search on her hands and knees, didn't say anything about her fear.
Okay,
McIntyre said. He shivered, a little reflexive shake against the cold.
Do you think Jack was meeting someone?
I don't know. Jack liked to hike alone. But when I was up there, I saw Gardaí at the quarry. Do you know what's going on out there? What if Jack saw something, saw someone while he was out there, and that's what got him killed? McIntyre frowned and shook his head.
I haven't heard, but I can find out.
He held his hand out for the phone, and when she didn't react, he took it from her hand. He pressed a button, waited.
You haven't turned it on. Have you checked his messages?
I can't, she said. I've tried charging it, but I think it's broken. I hoped maybe the Gardaí could examine it. Or if you can't get it working, maybe you could get his messages from the phone company? McIntyre nodded.
And you wanted to speak to Sergeant Riley about this?
Yes, I've spoken with him before. I thought he might be helpful.
Not Gartha Rogers?
Aisling flushed. No. He nodded slowly again, like he understood.
Rogers is an old-style Gartha. He's not always as proactive as he should be.
Yes.
If ever there was an understatement.
From the information you've given me today, well, I was aware on the periphery of some of it. But your brother's death was not my case. Put together like this.
He shook his head.
Look, if you won't repeat this, it's obvious that a shitty job has been done on this case so far. No offense, Aisling, but it shouldn't have come down to you to find this. It should have been traced from the beginning.
Will Gartha Rogers
Aisling let her voice trail off. She wanted to know if this would finally get Rogers kicked off the investigation.
This is still his case for now. But if you can leave this information with me for a few days, I'll see if we can make new arrangements.
His smile was a little warmer, as if they were friends and he was going to do her a special favor. And Aisling felt a little internal reaction, the smallest glimmer of dislike. Someone needs to go to the trailhead and look for evidence. There are rocks there, tree branches. Someone could have hit Jack on the head, and the rock could still be there, she said.
As I said, if you give me a few days, we can move this forward, he said.
And you'll keep me informed?
Certainly. If you give me your contact numbers, where you can be reached.
She gave him her details again, her address and how she could be reached at the hospital, her mobile number. He took a step closer to her and she caught a sour hint of stale sweat.
You're heading home now?
He asked. To work, she said shortly. Night shift. She hesitated. Look, Jack's sister, Maud, you arrested her. Do you know if she has a lawyer? Is it possible to visit her? She tried to read his face as he shook his head.
I'm sorry, no visitors until after her bail hearing. She can see her lawyer, but that's it, he said.
She noticed a little crust of sleep in the corner of his left eye. His skin had the thin, papery look of someone who wasn't getting a lot of rest. Did something new come to light? New evidence, I mean. It just seems, after all these years... She faltered.
I can't discuss the investigation with you, Aisling, he said, looking grave.
He hesitated.
I'd like to say more.
But he just shook his head. He walked her to her car, almost shepherding her, with his hand at the small of her back, a gesture that made her uncomfortable and left her with the distinct impression that he was in a hurry. He waited for her to get into her seat, put on her seatbelt, all the time holding the car door. Then he leaned in, a little too close.
One thing, he said, Maud Blake, I can see that you're worried about her, and I will look into this matter of the phone. But there's something I want you to think about.
He leaned a little closer.
Did you ever wonder that it might be too much of a coincidence that your boyfriend, her brother, the only witness to what happened that night 20 years ago, by the way, that Jack died in suspicious circumstances just after his sister returns to this country for the first time in 20 years?
Aisling opened her mouth to speak, but no words came out. He put a hand on her shoulder and squeezed gently. Her stomach turned.
Just think about it, he said. Think about it, and stay away from her.
Aisling nodded. She turned the keys in the ignition. He stepped back and she closed the car door. Through the rearview mirror, she saw him watching her as she drove away. The taste of fear returned and stayed with her until she reached the bright, welcoming lights of the hospital. Monday, 1st of April, 2013. Chapter 32.
Judge, the accused is a clear flight risk. She has lived outside this country for the past 20 years. She has no family and no property in this jurisdiction. It is our contention that she has already run to escape this charge. She disappeared on the night she murdered her mother, has been living abroad, and only returned 3 weeks ago, around the time of her brother's death, which took place in equally suspicious circumstances. The evidence against Ms. Blake is strong. We have a statement from a woman who says that Ms. Blake procured the heroin with the intention of injecting it at overdose levels when her mother was under the influence of alcohol.
Judge, I have to object to that.
Tom Collins stood as he spoke, but his manner was relaxed and his tone was measured, in contrast to the prosecutor's excited delivery.
Yes, Mr. Collins.
The judge, his wig slightly askew but his white collar pristine, was reading the papers, holding them up and slightly away, as if his glasses weren't quite addressing his long-sightedness.
I have a copy of the statement my friend refers to. The statement does not speak to Ms. Blake's intent. In fact, the witness says very clearly that she had no knowledge of Ms. Blake's intent at the time, and that Ms. Blake did not say what she intended to use the heroin for. Is this the case, Mr. Conway?
I believe so, Judge. I apologize if I misspoke. But I would argue that the evidence is very compelling. I am also told that there are further witnesses speaking with the guards, although written statements have not yet been taken. These witnesses still live in the local area, and there is a risk that the accused would seek to influence their testimony if she were released.
Judge.
Tom didn't stand this time.
Yes, Mr. Conway. You have appeared in my court on enough occasions to know that I am not interested in potential witnesses who have not given statements, and I am not interested in allegations of potential interference where there is no evidence that the accused has any intention or history of interfering with witnesses. If you wish me to consider potential interference, you will have to give me more to go on than that.
The judge didn't even look up. He was turning the pages of the statements that had been given to him, his manner casual, but the tone of his voice was steely.
Yes, Judge.
Conway's head was down now as he shuffled through the papers in front of him. He looked towards the back of the courtroom. Hackett was there, standing against the back wall, frustration evident on her face. She nodded her head firmly at Conway, who turned back to the judge.
Judge, there is an active guard investigation into the death of Miss Blake's brother, whose death was originally thought to be a suicide, but in the past number of weeks, evidence has come to light to suggest that his death may have been, due to a third party. In the circumstances, the Gardaí are concerned that Miss Blake will again flee the jurisdiction, as she did when a family member last died in suspicious circumstances.
Tom stood quickly.
Judge, I hesitate to suggest that any colleague would intentionally mislead the court, but the implications made here are really quite outrageous. Miss Blake has been tireless in her efforts to prompt the Gardaí to properly investigate her brother's death. The Gardaí have closed their investigation into Jack Blake's death. They believe that Jack committed suicide. My client does not. She has gone so far as to independently investigate his death and has provided Gardaí with evidence to prove that the Garda theory was entirely wrong.
Tom looked at the prosecutor, his expression disapproving. He was very good at this, Maud thought. She wanted to applaud. Instead, she sat stiffly, hands folded on her lap like a choir girl.
If my client was in any way involved in the death of her brother, she would have accepted the Garda decision that it was suicide, not sought to overturn it. Mr. Conway, the judge said.
The prosecutor didn't turn around this time.
I have no instructions on that matter, Judge.
That felt to Maud like an attempt to put distance between the prosecutor and his client, the Gardaí, and the judge was having none of it.
Well, perhaps you should take them, he said.
The prosecutor gave a jerk of the head to Rogers. He came forward, and they had a hurried, whispered discussion. There was another man standing at the back of the courtroom. He looked back at Maud solemnly. There was something familiar about him.
The judge had run out of patience. Well, Mr. Conway?
Judge, I am instructed that the defendant did provide the Gardaí with some evidence, but they do not accept the evidence as proof that Jack Blake's death was not a suicide.
Tom opened his mouth to speak, but the judge forestalled him.
Mr. Conway, the Gardaí must pick a position. If you maintain it was suicide, how can you argue that Ms. Blake was responsible for his death?
Conway tried to speak, but the judge raised his hand.
This is not a full trial of the action, gentlemen, and there are other applicants waiting to have their applications heard. I am not prepared to deny bail in this case, as the evidence before me has not satisfied the criteria I am required to consider. However, I am concerned about the accused's lack of connection with Ireland and her resources outside of the country, as well as her history of leaving this jurisdiction precipitously. Bail is therefore set at €100,000. If your client cannot provide a bond or surety, Mr. Collins, I will remand her into custody pending the next trial date.
The judge held his gavel above the block and raised his eyebrow in Tom's direction, the first time Maud realized that he had looked up from his papers since she had been called to the courtroom. Tom turned to her, his face pale.
It's more than I expected, he said. But it's bail.
Maud shook her head. It's fine. I'll pay it.
Mr. Collins, Miss Blake is to surrender her passport to the court. Bailiff, Kindly take Ms. Blake into custody and make arrangements for her to contact her bank.
The judge struck the block with the gavel, and a bailiff called the next case. Maud smiled at Tom, who seemed a little dazed. "What happens next?" she asked. The bailiff was waiting beside her.
"I'll meet you out there," said Tom. "We'll make bail arrangements, which might take a while. Once the money comes through, you'll be released. But I suppose, given it has to come from Australia, it may take some time. Worst case scenario."
Maud shook her head, but they didn't have time to say more. In the end, it didn't take long at all. They walked out of the courthouse 2 hours after the bail hearing. Tom took her arm as they left the court, steering her away from the only journalist who regularly haunted the steps of Galway Courthouse.
"Where did the money come from?"
he asked. Maud looked away, avoiding his gaze. Lawton had paid her well enough, and she'd had little to spend it on.
"I moved my money over after the station was sold. I had my savings, and John left me something. Once the station was sold, I didn't really have a place in Australia anymore. I thought I might come back to Ireland."
Tom reached out and squeezed her hand. She found herself staring down at his hand on hers. How easy it seemed for him now to touch her. How impossible it had been when they were young. She wondered if time had healed that part of him, or if it had been a relationship. And if so, where that person was now. Tom withdrew his hand, then put it protectively at the small of her back as they crossed the road.
"It fell apart pretty quickly for them, didn't it?" Maud said.
Tom shook his head.
"Faster than I expected, that's for sure. But it's not over yet, Maud."
"Hannah?"
"Should be released this afternoon. I have to go back to the office, make a call, just to be sure. Then I'd like to go to Dublin. Be there to collect her."
He stopped walking, reached out, and turned Maud towards him.
"What they said in there about Jack was appalling. Are you all right?"
"I'm fine," she said, then shook her head. "Actually, I'm absolutely starving. Have you time for a late breakfast?"
Tom started to laugh. Chapter 33. After the bail hearing, Cormac left the courtroom, crossed the street, and entered the town hall theatre. The box office was just inside the entrance. It was quiet, staffed by a young girl who showed a profound lack of interest in his presence. She was reading a magazine with Emma Watson on the cover and barely looked up at his arrival. The room had a large window that offered a perfect view of the courthouse exit, with the added benefits of making him a little less conspicuous and keeping him out of the cold. He watched Hackett and the prosecutor confer outside, the prosecutor gesticulating, very obviously angry, before they separated and Hackett turned in the direction of Mill Street. Hackett had fucked up, had sent the prosecutor in there with air for evidence, had actively misled him even. Once the lawyer was clear on his facts, there would be repercussions. It was a long time before Maud and Tom Collins appeared, leaving from the custody exit. They stood outside the courthouse and talked for a few minutes. The way Tom bent his head towards her when he spoke, the look he gave her when she laughed, there was such intimacy between them that he almost expected them to kiss. They hugged instead, then parted, Tom walking back towards the office, Maud crossing the street at the pedestrian lights and walking up Eglinton Street. Cormac took 2 quick steps down the theatre steps, crossed the street, and followed. She walked quickly, and when she reached the corner at St. Anthony's Place, she turned down towards Wood Quay. Cormac picked up his pace, but very nearly missed her. She had opened the door to a pub by the time he reached the corner. He followed her, a few beats behind. It was a maze of a place, with interconnecting rooms spread over 2 floors. He found Maud at the back, sitting at a table. She held a menu in one hand, but her attention was focused on her phone. She looked up as he approached.
"Do you know who I am?"
he asked. Up close she looked different, more attractive than he had expected. He'd remembered a child, and now there were fine lines around her dark eyes. She had freckles and a light tan where she'd been pale before. And though she was still slight, she looked much stronger.
"Yes," she said.
"I was at the bail hearing," he said, then stopped.
He didn't know where he wanted to bring this conversation.
"I would never have hurt Jack,"
she said.
I know that, said Cormac. I wanted to tell you that I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what just happened in there, and for any part I played in it. And I'm sorry for what I didn't do 20 years ago, when you were only a kid.
She gave him a smile then, an echo of that sad smile that he'd never quite forgotten, despite all the cases and all the years.
You've nothing to be sorry for, Detective. Nothing at all. You took us away from that house. There was nothing else for you to do.
I'm sorry then that no one stepped in before that night, that you felt you had to do what you did.
Her smile faded, and her face grew shuttered.
I know about Schiller, he said,
and he had the only confirmation he needed in the look in her eyes.
I know why you did what you did. Your mother was a monster. She beat you. She beat your little brother, and then she handed him over to a paedophile. You had no way out. Social services were useless. You already knew that. There was nowhere for you to turn, so you did what you had to do.
Her face had lost color. She closed her eyes for a long moment, then opened them.
My mother never touched us, she said, her voice faint.
You don't have to lie about it. There's no one left to protect Maud except yourself. Look, this is your defense. If you did this to defend yourself or your brother, you need to tell the truth.
It was the sort of thing he said to suspects. He'd give them something that looked like a way out, so that they'd bolt for it, only to find themselves in a noose. Was that what he was doing now?
Maybe not. He'd never felt so conflicted. My mother never touched us, she said again.
He shook his head, gripped the back of the chair in front of him. He opened his mouth to speak, but she cut across him.
It was Dominica Keane, she said.
He stared back at her.
My mother was an alcoholic. She was sick. She tried to get a job at the school, but the nuns wouldn't hire an unmarried mother. We had to rely on the allowance mother got from the state, and with the cost of the drink, there wasn't much left. Miss Keane offered me a job working on her farm, helping with milking. She didn't pay much, but we needed the money.
Cormac pulled the seat out and sat. A waitress came towards them, but veered away at a shake of his head.
She hit you,
he said flatly. Maud inclined her head. She liked to hit. She liked to hurt. But in the beginning it was just me, and I could handle it. She raised her chin, as if expecting him to contradict her.
Your mother didn't do anything about it.
We didn't talk about it. We needed the money. No one else would give me a job.
And Schiller?
She took a deep breath.
He was a friend of Miss Keane's.
You were afraid of him.
Maud was very still now.
Did he hurt you? Hurt Jack?
His voice was very gentle, but she shook her head.
I only met him once. He never touched me, or Jack either.
Because you stopped it. You knew what was coming and you stopped it, didn't you, Maud? You killed your mother because that was the only option. It was the only way to get you and Jack out of that house.
Her eyes were far away and very sad. Then Cormac felt a hand clasp his shoulder. He looked up to see Tom Collins, breathing fast and looking agitated.
Interviewing my client without my presence, Detective?
He asked.
Did you caution her?
No caution, Mr. Collins. This is just a conversation.
Tom pulled another seat over to the table, sat, and picked up a menu.
This is not the time or the place, Detective. If you want to interview my client, I suggest you make an appointment at my office.
He was making a valiant attempt at his usual professional poise, but Cormac couldn't miss his pallor.
That's not what this is about. I'm not your enemy. I'm not saying what you did was right, but I understand why you felt you had no choice.
But Maud and Tom were silent, unified now and unyielding. Cormac stood.
Your sister, Hannah, she got early release?
Tom gave a grim smile.
Yes.
Maud's phone buzzed where it lay on the table. Tom looked at Cormac.
You're going to lose this case, you know. Hannah's statement is not enough to convict Maud of anything. Hannah claims she gave heroin to Maud, but that's it. Even if you accept that evidence, All it proves is that Maud possessed heroin around the time her mother died. That's the very definition of circumstantial evidence, Detective. If you don't have anything else, then you have no case.
Cormac looked at Maud as he spoke.
Then it seems you have nothing to worry about.
Tom stared at him, trying to read him. When he spoke again, it was slowly and deliberately.
I'm not worried about the case. I'm worried about what your lot are going to do next.
Maud's phone buzzed again, and she picked it up, her eyes caught by whatever was on the screen, despite the conversation going on around her. Cormac concentrated on Tom.
Someone in the Gardaí wants Maud out of the way. Your Sergeant McIntyre went to my sister and pressured her into giving a statement. Do you hear what I'm telling you, Detective? He made up a story, went to my sister, and put it in her ear. Why did he do that? And why was Maud charged and arrested when you have nowhere near enough evidence for a conviction?
Cormac shook his head, not in denial, but because he didn't have an answer yet.
I don't know,
he said in the end. Christ, it was one thing to acknowledge his doubts, his questions in the privacy of his own mind. It was another to make them known to a lawyer, a defense attorney who could twist them, use them against the force. But Cormac's eyes went to Maud involuntarily, and he found himself saying,
I'm going to try and find out. You do that,
Tom said, then turned to Maud himself, concern in his eyes. But she was looking at her phone.
Maud?
Tom asked.
It's a message. From Aisling.
She looked up. She found Jack's phone.
On a hiking trail at Loch Mesk.
What, just now?
Tom asked.
Last night, said Maud. She sent the message last night, after she dropped the phone to the police station.
It took Cormac a moment to process the words, and then he was gone. Chapter 34. Cormac stalked back to the station.
Motherfuck! Everything came back to Danny. He was the one who had appeared with the heroin evidence. Danny and Mel Hackett had arrested Maud, and now there was a connection between Danny and Jack's death.
Lorna McIntyre's body had been pulled out of a quarry near Loch Mask, the last place, apparently, that Jack Blake had been alive. This was where Cormac ran into a brick wall. He saw the whole thing as a puzzle, every piece fit together, interlocking, with a single gaping hole. And the one piece he had in his hand didn't fit. Cormac was halfway down Shop Street when it started to rain. It was almost a relief. The street was pedestrianized and always busy, but in the rain shoppers tried to walk under shop awnings, leaving a center aisle that was unobstructed. He picked up his pace, ignoring the rain that soon plastered his hair to his skull and soaked through his shoes. Danny was knee-deep in the Maud Blake case, had been pushing it along behind the scenes, probably from the beginning. And the rumor about him sleeping with Maud? Danny was the obvious source for that. He was the only person in Galway who Cormac had spoken to about Emma. Still, he had no why. In their first week in Temple Moor, they had attended a lecture on court procedure. The class had been taught by a retired lawyer who liked an audience. He told them that motive was the least thing in any case because it need not be proven. It was not a legal element of crime. Intent or mens rea, that is the thing, he'd said. But he'd immediately countered his own argument by telling them that a Garda who prepared a file for prosecution without regard for motive was bound for disappointment. Juries, ultimately, needed a reason. Cormac reached the steps of Mill Street and ran up them, slowing to a slightly more decorous pace as he moved through the halls and up the inner stairs. He didn't want to draw attention to himself. The squad room was busy. Cormac took his seat quietly and logged on. First things first. The slow warm-up of his computer was infuriating. He tapped his finger on the mouse, the small movement nowhere near enough to release his increasing tension. He forced himself to calm down. Focus was what was needed now. He logged in, found the Lorna McIntyre case, and confirmed what he already knew. Her body had been found at Loch Mask. Identity had been confirmed that morning through dental records. No date or time of death had yet been determined, but there had been an arrest. Cormac scrolled down and clicked on the arrest report. Name of suspect arrested? Angus
Barton.
An anonymous call had been made to Mill Street on Saturday, prompting the search of the quarry. Barton owned the surrounding farmland and, according to the arrest report, had a prior connection with the victim. He'd been arrested and charged with her rape in December 2011, though charges had later been dropped. Cormac stared at the screen, willing the words to make sense. Fisher appeared at his shoulder, cleared his throat.
Yeah? I've sent the sample off, Fisher said, and I've started looking at the process for extradition warrants, if it is positive.
Right,
said Cormac. Fisher paused, then dropped his voice.
Murphy was looking for you earlier. Said if I was to see you, to tell you to call up to his office.
Rogers was crossing the room, heading for the door. Cormac looked at Fisher, who waited a beat, then shrugged.
Haven't seen you, have I?
And he left Cormac to it. Cormac caught Rogers before he reached the stairs.
I want that phone, Cormac said. Jack Blake's phone. If it hasn't gone to the lab yet, I want it going under my name.
Rogers looked back at him, surprise quickly turning to indignation.
There's no new evidence in the Blake case, and if there was, that case hasn't been assigned to you as far as I know.
Cormac was wearing plain clothes, but he pointed to his shoulder, where the epaulets of his uniform would be if he was wearing one. He took two quick steps towards Rogers, loomed over him.
I'm not in the mood for bullshit, Rogers. Get the phone to my desk and get it there now.
Cormac was barely back at his desk before the next interruption came, in the form of loud voices, laughing, joking, as Healy, Trevor Murphy, and all the rest of them entered the room as a troop. Healy gave Cormac an ironic salute as he walked to the other end of the room. And there was Carrie O'Halloran, her back towards him, head bent over her work.
Jesus, the answers were right here. They were in this room. He was sure of it. Could feel them tapping at the inside of his brain, begging for his attention.
Everything came back to Danny. Danny had set Kavanaugh up for drug dealing, which meant he had to get his hands on drugs. The obvious source of drugs for a policeman was the evidence locker, but a stash the size that Danny had used on Kavanaugh would not be easy to get hold of.
Jesus,
Cormac's eyes dropped to his phone. He thought of the video Matt had sent him, of Healy standing over plastic-wrapped bales of drugs as they were pushed into the incinerator. Except if Healy was involved, maybe what was in those bales wasn't drugs. Maybe the drugs had already been diverted elsewhere, stored and sold on by Healy, Trevor Murphy, and whoever else he had in his dirty little network. Maybe even Danny. Why the fuck hadn't he thought of this before? Danny didn't take the drugs directly from evidence storage himself. He hadn't needed to. He'd known about Healy's stash and had helped himself. If Danny had stolen from Healy, that would explain the obvious tension and animosity between the two men. It would also explain why Superintendent Brian Murphy had let Danny get away with so much. Setting up Kavanaugh, for example, and that was just for starters. If Danny had proof that Trevor Murphy had been involved in drug running or stealing drugs evidence for resale or whatever the fuck they were up to, what were the chances that Murphy Sr. would have looked the other way, rather than risk his son's future? Everything fell into place in Cormac's head. He had no proof, but he was convinced, although he still needed the why. He stood and walked to O'Halloran's desk.
I need to speak to you, he said. It's important and it has to be now.
He made his way downstairs and waited for her in the car park. She appeared a few minutes later, stood on the top step. Stopped there. When she didn't take another step, Cormac walked back towards her, stopping at the base of the steps. Even with that, she was just barely taller than him. She looked exhausted.
You found her,
Cormac said.
Yes.
Another anonymous tip.
Another?
Jack Blake's death was called in the same way. We got nothing useful about the caller.
Carrie sighed.
Nothing useful this time either. Call was from a burner phone to a Mill Street extension. A male who made a clumsy effort to disguise his voice said that Barton had confessed to him that he had killed Lorna and dumped her body in the quarry. Claimed Barton had run into her and Lorna had gotten angry, had said she was going to file the charges again. Barton is supposed to have killed her in a fit of rage, dumped her body in the flooded quarry on his land.
You've arrested him.
No choice. Her body was in the quarry on his land. We searched the place. There was blood-stained clothing hidden at the back of one of his wardrobes.
We sent it for testing, but I think we both know it will be her blood.
The wind whipped Carrie's hair across her face, and she pushed it back with one hand, looking past Cormac to the street beyond.
Everything leads to Barton. A great big neon sign pointing his way.
You don't think he did it?
Cormac said flatly. Her eyes returned to his.
I know he didn't do it.
He knew it too, knew it to his bones. But that didn't mean he understood.
Why would he kill her? His own sister.
A look of intense relief crossed Carrie's face and was gone.
He's not the person he pretends to be. Lorna was afraid of him. More afraid of him than she was of anything else. She was raped 1.5 years ago. She came to Galway to report it and I met with her. She came alone and her biggest concern was that Danny would hear of it.
Her eyes took his measure, trying to read how he was reacting to her words.
I've just come from the house. Danny's not there. He took compassionate leave, but he hasn't been near the parents.
Shit. Cormac hesitated only for a moment.
Jack Blake was there that day, at the lake.
Your dead boy?
She asked.
Danny's been all over the case from the beginning, pushing for the sister to be charged, coming up with evidence.
There was a noise from the station behind them. A pair of uniforms came down the steps, throwing curious looks in their direction. And then her phone rang. Carrie answered it, pressing the mobile to her ear, her eyes still on Cormac in a way that let him know that whatever this was, he needed to hear about it.
Stay where you are, she said into the phone. I'll be there in 5 minutes.
She hung up, sliding the phone back into her pocket, her eyes still locked with his.
I need you with me, she said. She might talk this time.
She waited only for his nod, and then she was running, Cormac 2 steps behind her. Chapter 35. The handover with Cummins hadn't exactly gone to plan. Aisling was there, ready and waiting at 8 p.m. At first she was relieved he was late. It gave her a chance to pull herself together after her scare at the quarry and her conversation with McIntyre. When he still hadn't appeared by 9, she assumed he was in a surgery that ran over. But when she went looking 1/2 hour later, she found that he'd changed his plans and wasn't coming in until 10. By the time he finally showed up, she'd been exhausted and furious and incapable of holding it all in. For the first time in her life, she told a consultant exactly what she thought of him, unprofessional, self-involved, with completely unrealistic expectations. She got it all out, then stood there, hyperventilating.